It's that time of year again. It's the Open Studios Art Tour, brought to you by Arts Obispo, featuring over 220 artists throughout the county. Coming right up. Stephen DeLuque here with Ears on Art, a program dedicated to the exploration and advancement of the visual arts. Ears on Art is produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, which serves the California Central Coast from Ventura to Salinas. This weekend, October 10th and 11th, kicks off the annual Open Studios Art Tour. Open Studios is a countywide program that provides the viewing public an opportunity to visit with artists in the intimacy of their creative workspaces. This allows the viewers to see and hear what the motivations and inspirations are for each participant in their own words. Today's guest is a first-time participant and a fabric artist, Sharon Emerson. When Sharon retired from her career in biological sciences, she delved into the world of art quilt making. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I visited with Sharon at her studio in San Luis Obispo. Sharon's studio is only open the first weekend, October 10th and 11th, and is not open on the second weekend, October 17th and 18th. Artists who participate in Open Studios have the option of either opening the first or second weekend or both.
We're here in the studio with Sharon Emerson. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to both you and Steve. I'm glad you're here in an intimate setting, I will say.
And yes, Stephen is here also.
Good afternoon, everyone.
By intimate, maybe you can give us a little sense of where we are in your studio.
I'm located on Sacramento in San Luis Obispo in the area that's a combination of residential and businesses, and have about 100 square feet of space in which to fit my sewing machine, my design boards, my fabric repertoire, and any visitors who show up.
It is always interesting to see how inventive people get with the amount of space that they have, whether it's a bedroom or a garage or something that they've built that's hundreds of square feet. Mm-hmm.
When I first saw this space, I wasn't sure it would work. But, you know, it has a total glass from ceiling to floor and a beautiful view over the railroad tracks to the hills beyond. So that made it definitely high in my list of things to take.
Give us a little overview of the nature of your work.
I would say I'm a fabric artist. I'm interested in using fabric, and fabric loosely defined, so it doesn't have to be commercially made. It can be hand-dyed. It can be recycled or reclaimed to make some kind of representation of things that I see in the world. I guess that's the easiest way to describe it. And I come from a tradition of quilters. I'm a fourth generation quilter, but I veered away from traditional quilting very early, mostly because I'm a slob. I couldn't make the lines meet to do the geometry correctly. So that wasn't an avenue for me. So I just started looking around and going to lots of different exhibits, just looking at art generally, and somehow it just happened. I started actually making quilts that weren't traditional quilts, but they still were bed size. I never did anything for anyone that had a deadline. let me back up and start with that, right? I mean, I had a very high pressure job when I worked, and I thought, really, do I need that kind of pressure to do something new in my life? So it started slowly. Over years, I would make a quilt, and then it would find a home. And mostly it went to friends, or I would have friends' children who were having hard times in their lives, and maybe I'd send them a quilt because, you know, everybody likes to get something out of the blue.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's how it started. And then, frankly, it just grew from there. I started reducing the size of my quilts. I started taking on less traditional fabrics. I started to do more quilts that had a personal message for me of some sort, right? And they really grew out of a collection of images, I think, that I have in my head over the years of work that I've done in the out-of-doors.
So what kind of high-pressure job were you working?
I was a research biologist. I studied evolution, and it was a high-pressure job because I lived off grants. So that meant that I had to write agencies to ask for money, and then I had to do the work. And then, of course, I had to publish in scientific journals in order to get more money. There's not a lot of sources for money for evolutionary biologists. And the funding rate from the National Science Foundation, which is the source of money, is, you know, hovers between 2 and 10%. So that was the downside of that job. But the upside of the job was I was my own person. I structured my research the way I wanted. And I spent most of my professional life working in part in very wonderful, rich areas of the world. I went to Borneo. I worked in Latin America. I've been to Africa. So, of course, when I was doing that kind of work, I also had to stop in towns along the way and pick up a piece of fabric or two. So much of the work that I do incorporates those fabrics and sort of images from those times in the rainforest when I was working.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. That was a lot.
No.
That was great.
Yeah, it's not a lot in terms of too much talk. It's a lot in terms of life, right? Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I listened to your last program. You know, I thought I want to, you know, be a little prepared here. So when I started listening to your program, someplace along the line, I heard someone say, left brain, right brain. And even though I was a scientist, I can't remember which part is supposed to do what. So I looked it up. I went to the internet and I looked it up. And I started thinking about this part of me that was the scientist and the part of me that is the artist. But as I was reading about left brain, right brain, it started breaking down. I mean, they had a review of how it started in the 70s and then how it's not so clear cut. And then I started thinking about, well, am I left brain and then right brain? But then, no, I realized I do my art exactly how I did my science. So I start out, I have these observations. In the case of the science, you know, it's maybe looking at the frogs that I'm going to study and, you know, where they're distributed. In terms of the art, it's just sort of looking at nature or looking out my front window or looking at the dishes in the sink. But once I have the observations, then you think there's a question or a problem in science and you formulate that. And in art, it's the same way. There's a question or there's a formula about how, what you're going to produce. What is this image that's going to capture that? So they're really basically the same. Whether you do DNA sequencing to find the answer or you go to a rummage sale and buy some used fabric and recycle it in an art piece, you're then coming together with sort of the evidence, if you will, for your original problem or question. So really, it's the same. And I increasingly feel that. I mean, I get the same pleasure and pain from both.
Well, historically, the sciences and the arts have been intimately tied to one another. You look at Da Vinci and how he excelled in the study of the sciences and geometry and all of that, and yet he also was a fabulous artist. And I've never understood why people think that it's an either-or situation.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think what made it seem like it was either or was really Sperry's work. I think he's a neuroscientist. He received a Nobel Prize, I think, in 1971, around then, identifying these two separate spheres of the brain. But after the initial work, they found that, generally speaking, there are some areas on the left brain that do different things than the right, but only in some people, not all the time. So it's complicated, you know, just like art, just like life.
And even beyond science and art, that delineation of saying that somehow you're born with the art ability and you have to learn everything else, I don't think that that's really true either. I mean, there's an awful lot of learning that we're all doing as we're trying to create. whether it's technically or, as you say, just trying to deal with that, what am I doing here? It just seems that we've done a lot of categorization that maybe if we're smart enough, we'll start to begin to break down. I think your description is quite wonderful. Oh, I'm me, and please don't divide my head in half.
Right, exactly.
I mean, it is sort of curiosity and solving puzzles, no matter whether it's science or art. It's almost that simple in a way.
I had a former student contact me recently, totally out of the blue, and she had taken my class as an elective, and she was a science major. And she found that the atmosphere in the art class was very different than the atmosphere in her science lab. It was kind of frightening at first that there was this much that wasn't prescribed, but she came to realize that it definitely was something that she needed. She says, don't discount those electives. They change your life.
I have to confess, I have never taken an art class because as a science major, you got one elective a semester, and for some bizarre reason, I took a Russian literature class once. I really feel often like I'm doing catch-up with art. I think that there are always ways in which classes and workshops can lead you new directions. There's no question about it. And there are certain kinds of technical things that you need to learn about the medium that you're going to work with. Right, one way or another. But, you know, I think people learn and do creative work in lots of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's like the brain discussion. It's all over the map.
Absolutely. I hoped, and still do as I teach, that the biggest thing that I can give somebody is possibly that way to just look a little differently at the world. I think that that's what I would mean by teaching art. If I had to give a definition, it's more, can you help people see?
Absolutely. That to me is the most difficult thing, I think, to get across to students is trying to view a subject from a completely different point of view and train yourself not to think in a linear fashion that way and try to see things from all dimensions.
This is how I feel about both the art I do and the science I did. I wanted to do both. But I didn't exactly fit in the mold of either. I mean, I'm not very linear, but on the other hand, I really am a slob about many things. So how could I use that plus and minus or you know, that more complex set of traits to forge a career in science or explore art? At times when I was a scientist, it was extremely difficult. I mean, because science especially is extremely rigid about what's acceptable and what you're supposed to do. And the emphasis is always on having a very narrow area of expertise, but being extremely good at it, being deep to China. And that wasn't for me a way to go. I really liked breadth. I really wanted to put my finger in lots of different parts of the science and bring it together. There wasn't really a lot of encouragement to do that. But on the other hand, I won a MacArthur.
You must have been doing something right.
It worked, right?
You have tuned in to Ears on Art, a program produced and recorded at listener-supported KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo on California's Central Coast. This weekend, October 11th and 12th, is the first of two consecutive weekends for the annual Open Studios Art Tour. Our guest today is first-time participant Sharon Emerson, whose medium is three-dimensional art quilting.
I'm sitting here thinking of this definition of slob as being somebody who doesn't put straight lines together, and I'm going, we're really in trouble.
Different kinds of yes. art have different requirements, and in more traditional quilt craft, precision is a huge aspect. I mean, in quilt contests, always in traditional quilts, it has to do in part in how closely your seams come together, the straightness of your stitch. And that's wonderful, but it's not something I can do very well. One of the things that helped me was just starting with a sewing machine. It sounds silly, but I started being a hand quilter because that's what you did.
Right.
That's what my mother taught me. And then I bought a sewing machine, about 10 years ago or so, when I started doing a little bit more arty things, and oh my golly, it was just so much easier. If I can show you an example, I'm making these bowls. You can see on these bowls that are about 18 inches across that they have, in addition to textured fabrics and a design, they also have very precise contour quilting. So it's definitely different than your traditional quilting again. It's much more like if you had a topo map and were going to hike in the mountains. You see the connection with biology?
Right.
This is what you'd be looking at, are these contour lines. And just being able to use these contour lines in some form have made a huge difference to me in my work.
Let's describe one of these bowls a little bit more in terms of, first of all, what's the core? What is, because people usually don't think in terms of fabric and bowls.
These bowls have a canvas core. So basically you have a circle that you cut out of canvas, and then you put darts around this circle. You can make the darts any width you want. Of course, when you close these darts, what it's going to do is make a sphere or bowl-like structure, and depending on the size of the darts, the bowls will be closer to a platter or more like your mixing bowl. And I have been working a lot with the platter side of making bowls because I feel like it gives me a little bit something like literally a canvas that I can put the other things that I'm doing on top of. I have to make layers of canvas to make it stiff enough. There are these wonderful materials you can buy that stick fabric together. And so I just use that to put it together. And then I start decorating the bowls. The sort of trick to this is to figure out where those darts are, when you're going to close them, and how to make them not show at the end. So that's sort of the, you know, the boring technical stuff, like, you know, what kind of clay you use and how you fire it in the kiln. But it's basically just a slightly spherical canvas that one puts their inspiration on. In addition to putting fabrics to make the design, I also then quilt it with these stitches that we talked about earlier that have topo map contours of various designs. And then the whole bowl is finished by a stitching that just sort of closes off the canvas so that you don't see it. In the quilting world, they're very unusual. And I credit my discovery of these to a wonderful quilt artist named Hilda Marin, who is out of Portland, Oregon. And I was fortunate enough to go up and take a workshop from her, my only art class, if you will. That was the beginning. This was like opening up the door to just endless possibilities.
I would presume also that your endless just observation, as you say, fourth generation, you have watched people do a lot of sewing. So the idea of how to think about darts, how to think about sealing something off, how to think about any of that may have been kind of subconscious, but it was there, or it was very conscious.
That's a great story, Chris, but I'm not sure I believe it for a second.
Yay!
When I was a kid, the worst thing, my mother and grandmother made me clothes. Ooh-wee. You know, oh, I wanted a store-bought dress so badly. You know? So, yeah, I mean, I think I did watch it. But it's funny you said that. I never thought of that transferring to this because, frankly, at my age, I think sometimes I can't even remember what I did with the last bowl, you know? It's just sort of like every one of them seems to be starting again a little bit, you know? I mean, I have a general idea, but I'm not sure I absorb too much.
Perhaps not. But it goes back to just the lack of facility that you've acknowledged about straight lines, but at the same time, finding that you could get real enjoyment out of this discipline by allowing yourself to not be hampered by that structure.
That definitely is the case. Part of why I'm a fabric artist is because I love the feel of the fabric and all the embellishments, the ribbons and the feathers or buttons. I love, for example, I have a piece that's going to be in the Open Studios Art After Dark display. And I love this piece because, first of all, the inspiration of it came from a photo my husband took of Morro Rock. And then I found this fabulous hand-dyed fabric that somebody else had made. And then I could put on it these beautiful buttons that I bought in Buenos Aires at a garage sale 5 years ago. It doesn't get better than that. Is this art? That's the question. You know, there are a lot of fun things I like to do that get put down on top of this canvas. That's all I'll say about it.
Oh, goody. Now we're back to that question.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't it be art?
I tried to read up a little bit on what is art because, you know, I thought I knew I was going to get asked this. And I'm not sure I do know what art is, but I think art is just some sort of personal expression by the person who makes it. And this whole idea that if something's functional or not should be included as a difference between craft, for example, and art, I don't see that that's so important, actually. I was downtown the other day. I love going to the used bookstore and looking to see if there are any old quilt books around. And so there was this book that I just bought. It was talking about the art quilt in 1986 when it was really anew. What happened basically with art quilts is that they started out of course, more traditional quilting. But when did it happen? It really started happening in a more serious way, that is, more people were doing it in the 60s. Of course. It's like when everything was being sort of looked at and expanded and turned upside down.
As you say, we've seen a huge explosion of expression, especially in the fabric arts. And I first remember running into it in the 70s with soft sculpture and things like that. And it was really fascinating to me to see the different directions that everybody took. There was no uniformity to the movement at all.
I was just looking at the stack of bowls here.
I was going to say, that's only a few. This is the first time I've ever done open studios, so I felt that I had to make a number of bowls. So I have had, as my husband said, a bowl obsession for about 6 months.
I make boxes out of metal, mostly. Okay. And so the question comes to me is, what's the box for? For me, a box is a box. It isn't about what goes in it. It's about the box. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be surprised if you get some of those questions.
I've already been asked that. It is this reflex action. We see a familiar shape, and we associate it. It must have a function, right? And frankly, I don't care what people do with these bowls once they take them away, right? I mean, I have given them what my creation or my art, and it's sort of like the whole next part of the artistic process. It's up to them how they want to keep that going or not, or change it, or whatever they have in mind. So I will say, if you put fruit in these bowls, they probably won't stay the same. That's all I have to say about it. People like to touch them. They're very tactile. That's another reason why I like making them, because you can pick them up. You can't hurt these bowls. I mean, they're sewn. Right? They're done. I mean, you know, you could tear off the buttons or something, but, you know, otherwise, pick them up, you know? And then, oh, yes, I forgot to talk about these bowls. Can we talk a little bit
about
this?
Sure.
I had to make some Day of the Dead bowls for Open Studios because, of course, that's going to take place just about the right time to have those things in your house.
Correct.
If not on your wall. I have so much fun making them. These are definitely take way liberal use of commercial fabric. And it just is very wonderful to cut up and reconfigure it, you know, into some kind of fabric collage.
And as may be presumed, these are images making use of skulls.
I forgot to add that part, definitely. Yes, there are a lot of skeletons of different shapes and marigolds, which is the flower of the Day of the Dead, and that's why they're orange, and they have flowers on them, and they have a few sayings in Spanish, and a couple of them on the back have a little skull as well. So,
I'm just loving these. Especially the Day of the Dead ones. Those are just so fun.
Oh, I know. I just brought a couple in. I just had such fun making these, right? I just I have about six of them. It is interesting to me. This whole Day of the Dead thing has become so popular, and it's so nice in a way, mm-hmm. because it really speaks to the heritage of this area.
The Arts Council used to set up an altar every year at Day of the Dead, and people were to bring in things from people who had passed, and they placed them on the altar, and it was a wonderful celebration.
I still remember I was living in Ecuador for a short time, about 15 years ago, and I had just had a very tragic death in my family. Day of the Dead is traditionally a Mexican observation, but some other Latin American countries and other countries around the world have something similar to it. So because we were living in Ecuador, we were out in the country, we went to this small cemetery, and it was so wonderful to see these families celebrating the remembrance of loved ones. And maybe the part I like most about it, this was a very rural place in Ecuador. What they had done for decorations was to make these hand pinwheels that they made out of potato chip bags that have the shiny inside. So they just cleaned them, turned them inside out, and made these dramatically cool pinwheels that people carried around. And just the whole day was such a feeling of love and caring. Amazing. My studio will be open only the first weekend, October 10th and 11th, from 10 to 5. I'll be here showing my bowls and probably doing a little bit of sewing. And I've tried to put up just a few pictures to show a little bit how I get to the final creation that I make. And I thought that would be a good basis to start some interesting discussions for people when they come by. So there'll be bowls and other things that will be available for sale.
I think that we could probably be talking for hours. Your life is such an interesting, you know, book. We'll go back on the travel road sometime. I mean, I'm just really intrigued with all of that. Half an hour is half an hour. So
that's it.
Just want to thank you for coming by and sharing the studio with me. And I look forward to people coming for Open Studios. And I look forward to hearing this broadcast.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful time here, and good luck.
Co-host Krista Hewitt and I would like to thank our guest, Sharon Emerson. Sharon is a first-time participant in this, the 17th Annual Open Studios Art Tour. Sharon's studio is only open on the 10th and 11th. Check the catalog to see when each of the participating artists is open to the public. The catalog may be viewed online by visiting artsobispo.org. Co-host Krista Hewitt has an exhibit of photographs at the Steinberg Gallery and Cafe. Krista invited two poets, Glenna Luce and Marguerite Costigan, to compose poems based on the photographs. There will be a poetry reading at the Steinberg this Friday, October 9th at 7 p.m. I am Stephen DeLuque. Thank you for tuning in to Ears on Art, a program produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, serving California's Central Coast. Krista and I would like to once again thank today's guest, Sharon Emerson, a first-time participant in the countywide Open Studios Art Tour. And speaking of Open Studios, both Krista and I are participants as well. I, along with my studio mate, Glynis Chafin-Tingloff, will be open both weekends at 1310 Van Buren Drive in Los Osos. Krista, too, is open both weekends at 69 Benton Way in San Luis Obispo. Krista is sharing her studio with Mae Wilson and Beverly Brown. I hope you'll be able to get out this weekend and visit some of the incredible artists that call San Luis Obispo County their home. Have a good afternoon.